Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We just heard from the song Mary by Joe Arroyo. That's a classic example of salsa music. And if that song made you want to dance, why not go to Cuba to learn how? That's one thing some visitors are increasingly headed to Cuba for, is it's salsa dancing and it's salsa dancing instructors. President Obama has relaxed travel restrictions for Americans, too, for other reasons. We'll talk about what else besides salsa dancing folks are headed to Cuba for due to these travel restriction the changes in the travel restrictions with our guests, Joe Mas and also Joe Azell. Joe Mas was born in Havana, Cuba, and now works as a trial attorney in Columbus, Ohio. He's appeared as well on WOSU's Columbus on the Record. Joe was formerly the executive director of the Ohio Commission on Hispanic Latino Affairs and is currently chair of the Ohio Hispanic Coalition. He has received the Distinguished Hispanic Ohioan Award and the Silver Key Award from the American Bar Association. Joe Mas, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann.
And also joining us from Miami is Dr. Jose Azell. He's a senior scholar at the Cuban and Cuban American Studies Institute at the University of Miami. He is the author of Mañana in Cuba, The Legacy of Castroism and Transitional Challenges for Cuba. Jose, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
Appreciate it. Let's just kick off with the subtitle of your book. It's called Mañana in Cuba, The Legacy of Castroism and Transitional Challenges for Cuba. Let's talk about the lexicon a little bit, because is it a transition, or what do we have ahead of us here between Cuba and the United States?
Well, we have not seen anything remotely resembling a legitimate transition to democracy or to a free market economy. What we have seen so far is fundamentally a succession from Fidel Castro to his brother Raul, but nothing in terms of a transition as we saw in some of the Eastern European nations. In fact, if we look at the so-called reforms that have been proposed by General Castro, what we find is a minimalist attempt to improve the economy, but nothing in terms of political freedoms, civil liberties, or political rights. In fact, the reforms are almost laughable if they were not so tragic. For example, the centerpiece of these so-called reforms is that they will now allow Cubans to be self-employed in precisely 178 activities. The activities are things such as refilling cigarette lighters, being an attendant at a public bathroom for tips, making paper flowers to sell to tourists will now be permitted, and things of that nature. It's not the kind of reforms that will conduce to a genuine transition.
It's an economic change. It's economic. It's not political then. And
economics, but minimalist.
I'm sorry, pardon me?
Economics, but minimalist. There's nothing in the on the political side. There are no reforms in the political side. But even those on the economic side, as I said, are really allowing some private sector's activity in service type of activities, and only 178 prescribed activities.
And what sort of economic activities would, if they were to broaden that number from 178 to more, what would you see as true reform in terms of the economy?
The logical thing to do would be to say, people are free to conduct themselves economically as they please, and perhaps constrain a couple of sectors for the state that the state may consider to be strategic or the like. But allowing Cubans to refill cigarette lighters or to repair umbrellas, and by the way, these are precisely the activities, repair umbrellas, those are not serious economic measures.
Have you been to Cuba lately?
No. I left in 1961 as a political exile. I consider myself a political exile, and therefore I cannot return until the conditions that brought about my exile cease to exist.
But Florida law also restricts state colleges and universities from traveling to Cuba. right?
Well, the restrictions have been watered down quite a bit, and for the most part, people can travel, you know, with certain constraints, of course.
So, Joe Moss?
Yeah, and I just wanted to add, I think that the professor's position is a legitimate and traditional position that many Cuban Americans have adopted and embraced and continue to do so, and that is that they consider themselves, we consider ourselves exile. There is a difference of opinion with respect to some people that travel to the island, as I did, to visit family. And I was wondering if the professor also can comment, because it's my understanding that there are people that feel as the professor does, formally and officially, but at the same time, sort of under the table, they do travel to Cuba to visit family and send money and medicines and other things.
Well, if I may, I concur, and I absolutely have no objections to Cuban Americans visiting their family members and helping their family members and doing whatever they can to improve the well-being of loved ones in the island. I personally would not travel. That is a very personal decision, but I have no criticism whatsoever towards those that choose to travel. That is certainly their right and their prerogative, and I would not criticize that.
So on this side of the equation, then, as the president loosens up restrictions for Americans to travel, is that a good thing, or is it irrelevant in the terms of whatever you want to call it, whether it's a transition or change or?
Well, let us sort of make a point. You know, some people will argue that travels by Americans to the island will help to bring about democracy. They will expose Cubans to democratic concepts and the like. I think that is a flawed premise. For the last 20, 30 years, we have seen millions of Canadians, Europeans, Latin Americans, Orientals traveling to Cuba freely. And they have not in any way induced that government towards democratic governance. It is somewhat strange that we think that Americans could do what Canadians and Germans and French and Italians and so on cannot accomplish. So that argument is flawed from that point of view. It makes no sense to argue that. Moreover, chances are, as the introduction to your program sort of suggested, that a North American that travels to Cuba will be kept separate for the population. More likely than not, they do not speak Spanish. They will be in an enclave. They will be drinking mojitos in Varadero, and they're not really going to have an impact. The same, however, is not true from Cuban-American travel. Cuban-Americans, of course, will speak the language, will visit their relatives, will maybe move to, be in their hometowns, and they could have a more important impact as they mingle with the Cuban population. So we should make a distinction between those two forms of travel.
Okay. Joe Moss?
I think that there are different. I do believe that the United States will be viewed differently with respect to the ease of restrictions of travel and the impact, the emotional impact, the psychological impact it can have on the Cuban people, because it is about the United States. Every economic failure that Cuba has had, and I'm speaking in generalities here, has been blamed on the embargo, on the blockade.
The United States.
By the United States on Cuba. I think that once that is eliminated, and I guess privately at least, I believe that the embargo should end. And I think that it should end for the simple reason that it will have a positive emotional impact and would promote democracy in Cuba, because then the excuses evaporate. And I think that the people of Cuba are waiting for that. And I think that particular first shot, that particular salvo, will be the beginning of true dialogue, at least in private at first and maybe later in public, among the Cuban people. And I also want to respectfully correct something that the professor cited about the Americans being kept on an enclave. In my recent visit, I saw Americans traveling throughout the city and were not restricted in seeing anything or talking to anyone. It is true that with respect to what I did see with respect to Canadians and British and French and other visitors is that they do tend to go to the resorts.
They're not interested.
But they don't seem to be as interested in the phenomenal things that I saw from my youth that was such a revelation and such a great spiritual revisiting for me. In Havana itself, and they do tend to be there to celebrate the sunshine and the music and the rum.
Professor Ezell, Latin America is enjoying pretty unprecedented democratic rule and economic growth, with the exception of Cuba almost. Can Cuba catch up?
Well, given Cuba can certainly cash up under two conditions. One, that democracy prevails, and two, that a free market economy is adopted. It can certainly not move anywhere within a totalitarian regime and with a centrally planned command economy. Cubans are entrepreneurial. We have demonstrated that in the United States. I think the Cuban American community has been extremely successful, and so in the conditions that would be required would be to empower human beings to pursue their happiness and to pursue their dreams. That will not be forthcoming within a totalitarian system, and it is certainly contradictory.
You know, in China, I mean, everybody is waiting for China's economy to overtake the rest of the world, let alone the United States and the EU. And yet there are not significant freedoms are still lacking in China, and it's been a bone of contention for a lot of Americans as well. They've managed to succeed economically. What do you think the difference is, the island economy versus the most populous or one of the most populous countries in the world kind of a situation?
Exactly, and I have written extensively about that, because one of the things that is proposed for Cuba is the so-called China model. And the two things cannot simply be compared. For example, China has a population of over 1 million people and makes it very attractive for foreign direct investors to invest in China. It's almost impossible to avoid that. Whereas Cuba is a fairly insignificant Caribbean island that will not be able to attract foreign direct investments without legal guarantees and an independent legal system. And that is the core of democracy. You must have divisions of powers. You must have an independent judiciary able to adjudicate disputes between people. And that's not going to happen under a totalitarian system.
Jomash,
yeah,
lawyer.
If I can, I tell you, and I am in nearly perfect agreement with the professor, particularly on one of the elements that he cited. I think that if I were to advise American and an Ohio company as far as investment in Cuba, I have to say that there has to be a demonstrable track record with respect to the security of that investment, and Cuba has not been able to demonstrate that. And certainly not with American investment. I think with European investment there has been some mixed history there. But without that, I agree with Professor Ezell. I cannot imagine that American investment would be forthcoming.
Coming up, we'll continue to hear from Joe Mas about his recent visit to Cuba. Right now, I want to say thanks very much to Professor Jose Ezell. He is a senior scholar, the Institute for Cuban and Cuban-American Studies. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, and thank you to my tocayo for being part of this program. Have a nice day.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you, and I should note that Professor Ezell and Joe Mas arrived in the United States just about in the same year, 1961.
Almost.
Joe was 12 years old, and Professor Ezell was 13 years old.
That's
so,
right.
So lots of memories, still old enough to remember awful lot.
Absolutely.
We'll talk about that when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. At 1 o'clock, On Point begins and a discussion of the U.S., Israel, and the Arab Spring. Join us for that discussion at 1 on Point. And you can get access to our station anytime online at WOSNew.org. Hear local and national news all day, every day, from the convenience of your computer by streaming on the web. Listen to 89.7 NPR News online anytime at WOSNew.org.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Central Ohio Trauma System, working with community partners to make Central Ohio a safer place to live. Details about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the Central Ohio Trauma System are at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
66 degrees with some light rain in Columbus. Showers and thunderstorms are likely off and on throughout the day. At times, we could see a little bit of sunshine, a high of 83. Showers and thunderstorms tonight and a low of 64 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. My guest is Joe Moss. He's a local attorney in Columbus. He's been a guest on Columbus on the Record many times, and we welcome him to this show. We're going to be talking about his recent visit to Cuba. We were just talking about the political stakes, political and economic stakes in Cuba right now, given relaxations of certain restrictions on both sides of the coin. If you have a question or comment for Joe, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're also on the web at wosu.org/allsides, and you can comment on Facebook there as well. We have an email from Rosa. She writes, "What are the sentiments of local Cubans towards Americans and American tourists? I am sure in tourist spots we are welcome, but I am talking more, quote, the man on the street, quote, type of feedback."
Yes, and I noted absolutely no resentment. I think that the general sentiment is that the what they call the blockade, the embargo, and everything that has resulted from that, and also some of the political commentary from the part of this country towards Cuba and so on, is just that. It's political dialogue. It does not reflect the sentiment of the American people. And, of course, Americans that are traveling to Cuba are individuals that are interested in finding out about the island.
There are still limitations. You just can't waltz off to Cuba still.
You can, but let me tell you, tens of thousands of Americans have, in fact, violated the law and have traveled to Cuba through third countries, and they just haven't reported it. And that is a position, that is a political statement, perhaps, that they have made. That's not how I traveled, but that's they have made that.
This was your first time back since 1961.
My goodness. Tell us
how you ended up going back now, and tell us about your, you know,
if you don't mind.
There's
kind of a backstory related to this. My wife is professor at the Methodist Theological School in Ohio, right up the road here in Delaware. And the school was interested in researching a cross-cultural trip for the seminarians. And Linda and I,
Linda Mercadante,
who's been on your program. We were researching this. We had visited with the head of the Cuban Interest Section in Washington, D.C., and so on, and happened to be commenting this in front of our children. And my oldest daughter, Sarah, who's very opinionated, she puts her hands on her hips, and she said, "I can't believe you're considering going to Cuba without taking us first." And I found that very moving, and so I started planning about a year ago. I started planning a trip for all of us to go, their spouses and so on, taking advantage of the quote-unquote general license that is permitted to Cuban Americans to visit family in the island, because I do have an aunt that embraced the revolution, and she worked for the Department of Justice for the Castro regime and is now retired, and I had not seen her in 50 years. So that was the beginning of this particular pilgrimage back.
So is she your only living relative in Cuba?
Yes, yes. The other relatives have passed away.
Did most of them leave when you did?
Most of my relatives left. The ones that were younger, the ones that were older, stayed behind and then either decided to live out the rest of their days there, or in waiting for permission to leave, they passed away. That would have been three of my grandparents.
Tell us how you came to the United States.
My own journey, of course, as it happens with so many people, including the professor, Professor Azell, that was just on, is that we were children. And our families, in the professor's case, they sent him by himself during the Pedro Pan flights of the early 1960s. In my case, my mother and my stepfather were able to leave and took me and my little brother with them.
When you were 12 years old, were you aware? That's a pretty lucid age.
Absolutely.
Were you aware of the circumstances?
I was aware of the circumstances, and in the early days of the revolutions, the circumstances were right in your face. There was a dramatic change in the culture. It was the beginning of a totalitarian state, and in the early days of the revolution was also very dangerous because people that were considered to be enemies of the revolution were imprisoned, and in some cases, in hundreds of cases, were also executed. So there was a sense of danger in those early days that certainly inspired a lot of people to leave. 1.2 million, I should say.
Did you notice anything in terms of your education? Because an issue I wanted to get to with Professor Azell, and we didn't have time, was of when we study changes, when totalitarian governments change and try to go through change, for instance, in Eastern Europe, it's a good example. We typically focus on their political, economic, and legal systems. I know I have, as a journalist, more their legal systems, for example. Largely ignored is the role of education, down even at the elementary or in high school,
yes,
level, that kind of a thing, in transforming the values and in transforming,
absolutely,
the behaviors. And I was wondering if you remembered any kind of experience of transformation in your education before you left at 12.
Oh, yeah. And you saw the beginning of that. And what happened, and it happened the year that I left, is that the private schools were then abolished. And the reason for that was in order to have a generalized education at all levels that incorporated the vision of the revolution. Now, mind you, the vision of the revolution changed with the passage of time, because
right,
one of the basic tenets was that we were going to have elections within the first, I think it was 9 months.
Didn't
after
happen.
And it just not only did it not happen, it hasn't happened, right, in the past 53 years. So you saw that. You saw also the inspiring the young children to inform on their parents, all of the horrible things that maybe you saw in Dr. Zhivago, let's say, mm-hmm, to cite a point of reference, actually was happening in Cuba. A lot of things that people were concerned about, that the children were going to be taken away from their parents, which was the inspiration for the Pedro Pan movement by the Catholic Church and the United States government, actually did not happen. And, of course, with the passage of time, then things stabilized. But in the early years, it was frightening, yes.
We have an email from Bob, and I'm pretty sure it was directed to Professor Azell, but I'll read it and just see what your mm-hmm, impression is. He says, when your guest calls for free markets, as did Professor Azell from the Institute for Cuban and Cuban American Studies in Miami, does he refer to Fulgencio Batista's plantation economy of the 1940s and 1950s, the existence of which fueled Fidel Castro's revolution?
You know,
what's your impression of what
I have? Let me say at the outset that my point of view with respect to the dialogue on Cuba and the elimination of the embargo and all of that is liberal. Okay, I'd like to see the full reestablishment of relations and everything else. At the same time, I don't want to romanticize the revolution too much, and I certainly don't want to demonize the economic side of the Cuban experience, whether it be under Fulgencio Batista or under previous presidents or dictators, Machado for one, and so on, because the economy continued on, and it was not totally independent of, but generally independent of government, so that I would not refer to it as a plantation economy. I think Cuba had a dynamic economy. I think if you look, and they're available on the internet, on YouTube and all that, if you look at the old travel logs of the period of the 1930s, 1940s, you would see a thriving community and a place that you can understand why Americans were traveling back and forth so much. So I don't necessarily agree that that's the case. At the same time, Cuba needs to go a long way in order to be able to, and I think the Cubans are are looking for that. The Cubans on the island are looking for the liberalization of the economy so that they can make things and sell things.
You know, we made just scant reference to it earlier, but the whole issue of the island economy, it's a very small country. It's an island economy. There's always a certain limitation associated with that.
Yes, and also geographical because it's an island, but it's right. So close to the United States, and it's so easy to get from one place to the other and to transport goods, that I think that would be sort of a minimal impact. Cuba, I'm going to say something fairly revolutionary, perhaps. I don't think Cuba needs to go very far economically in order for it to catch up with the rest of the Caribbean basin. I think some relatively minor things need to happen, possibly even including the – and by the way, Associated Press announced last night that they had received word that the Obama administration, maybe today or maybe tomorrow, were going to further liberalize travel to Cuba, expecting as many as 500,000 additional Americans to visit the island. So I think those changes will help and will infuse additional dollars – revenues and to the island, which will help the people.
So, Joe Mas, what did you find when you went to Cuba?
Oh, my goodness. Not what I thought I was going to find. And I have to stay even here. I don't want to get too emotional. You know I can get emotional. But anyway, I found, let me say that three things. Obviously, the shock of seeing your homeland and for the first time. But interesting thing, I traveled with a Cuban passport, which the head of the Cuban intersection suggested I get. So I go through customs, and they call a senior official to come and talk to me. I thought perhaps they were looking for me. Maybe I was the only one with a Cuban passport traveling. And his first words to me is, "What took you so long to return?" And I thought that was a very sweet response. And no problem, of course, getting in and so on. But there are three things that I noted that I wasn't expecting that shocked me or impressed me. The architecture, the food, and then a change in the personality, the fundamental personality of the Cuban people. And those were three things I was not expecting.
So how was the architecture unexpected?
It's the vastness of the 16th, 17th, 18th century, and early 20th century houses, businesses, public buildings, and so on that go on for block after block after block and square mile after square mile. I've traveled throughout the Caribbean, I've traveled in Europe, and I haven't seen, I didn't remember it like that. I haven't seen anything like that in the entire world. And it's small wonder that the United Nations has declared that the architectural content of Cuba is an international treasure.
Is this because the economy, such as it was after the revolution, couldn't afford to replace all these buildings, so they had to preserve them?
Exactly. National Geographic recently had an article about the missions in California, you know, the Camino Railroad in California, and they said that the ones that are in best condition today are the ones that belong to parishes that people couldn't afford to do anything, couldn't put air conditioning in, couldn't paint over the
– right?
It's a great irony. Now, on that side, let me tell you that many of the buildings, particularly outside of the Habana Vieja, the old part of the city, are in dire need of repair. And I would hope that internationally, nationally, by means of the elimination of the embargo, that resources are afforded so that the people can do that.
What about the food?
I'm ashamed to
do
mention
you love
it.
To eat, and that's what
I loved it. No, the problem is that the food was absolutely terrible.
Oh.
And my apologies to my brothers and sisters on the island. But I think what happened is that and I guess I know what happened is that because of the economic problems that Cuba has had over the past 53 years, they have not had the resources available in order to maintain the cuisine, to maintain the culture. Linda, my wife, was telling me, she read a book that a similar thing happened in Ireland as a consequence of the elimination of resources because of the English taking over the land and all of that, that their cuisine also evaporated. There was a loss of the common memory for the food, and that was surprising. I had heard that the food was not good, but I thought people didn't know what to ask for. I knew what to ask for, and it just wasn't there, and that saddened me. But hopefully, within months after being able to have some free exchange and maybe some increased revenues and so on, that will correct itself.
Because there's a very distinctive Cuban cuisine.
Absolutely.
Traditional
and
Cuban
you get anywhere
cuisine.
And I have eaten at Cuban restaurants in Europe, in Latin America, in Mexico City, in all over the world. And the food is very consistent. The dishes are very consistent. That you have vaca frita, ropa vieja. You have the boliche. And you find that in Cuba today, you can't find that. And I thought that was so odd. It's so interesting.
And then the people.
The people have calmed down quite a bit. And that was the third surprising thing in my experience. Cubans had I think they embraced a personality that was joyful, boisterous, that was looking for opportunities to have fun, work hard certainly, but have fun all the time. I did not see that on the island today. If anything, I saw a prevailing seriousness among all of the people that I interface with, the taxi drivers and the people in the tour, the people in the hotel, the people on the street, that I don't remember and that you don't see within the context of Cuban Americans, let's say, here in the United States or Cubans living elsewhere in the world. Lots of rules.
Do you think that they act differently towards you because,
no.
You know, you're Cuban American?
There was a degree
of... And you can speak and you probably tell the taxi driver immediately.
Well, I think there might have been a little suspicious. Now, I'm traveling with a Cuban passport, first of all, and I'm traveling as a... somebody visiting family, but I think there was some degree of distrust. But more than one person referred to Cuba as the country of rules, quote unquote, the country of rules, and they seemed to be wary of doing the wrong thing or being in the wrong place. I wanted to visit one of the schools that I attended, the Havana Military Academy. And unfortunately, the land where the school was is now the estate of Raul Castro, the president of Cuba. And so we tried to get a picture of it and couldn't. Again, the taxi driver was very, very concerned about violating any of the rules that might make it seem like he was doing something wrong and then he would be questioned. So there is a lot of that still.
Are you concerned about reclaiming that traditional...
Yes.
What's the word? Wadi vivre?
Yes. I am concerned that may have been lost.
French.
Yes, but you know, at the same time, if there is going to be economic development, you have within the population of Cuba, well educated, and literacy rate is 99.8, the highest in the world, and you have people that are serious and willing to work. Well, if I was thinking of investment on the island, maybe that's not a bad thing to have. And maybe we will recapture that in the next generation.
Well, Joe Mas, I want to thank you today for joining us.
You're welcome, Ann. Really enjoyed it.
Really,
thank you.
It was very interesting. I wish we would have more time. Joe Mas, he's a local attorney. You've seen him on Columbus on the Record. We just talked about his trip to Cuba, his first since 1961 when he moved to the United States after the revolution. Coming up, Roger Blackwell, marketing expert, public speaker. He's in the news lately, sort of, after returning from prison after 6 years. So join us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear conversations that you won't hear anywhere else.
Do you understand love?
Well, I understand caring. See, most of my relationships are more intellect, and to me, love is caring.
Posing questions to fascinating people like Temple Grandin and giving them the time to answer on Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon. And on Fresh Air today, Jimmy Fallon, the host of Late Night, tells us about his years with Saturday Night Live and getting to host his own talk show. That discussion begins on Fresh Air at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Craft in America promotes and advances original, handcrafted work and inspires people of all ages to pursue their own creativity. Audiences explore issues from identity, history, philosophy, ancestry, cultural exchange, repression, and freedom. Tuesday night on WOSU-TV, watch the episode Messages as it explores the ways many craft artists go beyond skill to personal and political expression. Watch Craft in America Tuesday night at 8 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from the state auto insurance companies providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com.
68 degrees with cloudy skies, showers and thunderstorms off and on throughout the day, and a high of 83. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Joining me now is Roger Blackwell, Dr. Roger Blackwell. He has been in the Columbus area since 1965, joined the marketing faculty at Ohio State University after receiving his PhD from Northwestern University, and his undergraduate and master's degree at the University of Missouri. He's written many, many books. We're going to be talking later on about marketing and the census and what it says about where we're going. He'll be talking about that this week at the Columbus Metropolitan Club. But a lot of people are wondering where you've been the last 6 years. We can't talk about some aspects of the case in which you were convicted of 19 counts of stemming from an illegal insider trading tip you gave to family and friends. First of all, why don't we talk about why you can't discuss the case and what you can talk about?
Well, there's still an appeal going. And first place, I want to say it is a pleasure to be back at the Ohio State University.
Okay, we've got some camps forming now.
For your attentive listeners.
Okay.
And actually, that's a copyright issue, you know. It's proper to say the Coca-Cola Company, but a lot of people say Coke as an abbreviation of the Coca-Cola Company. But at the bottom of every ad, you will see Coke as owned by the Coca-Cola Company. And in fact, if you go into a restaurant and say, give me a hamburger and Coke, I'm sure all of your listeners have heard people say, is Pepsi okay? Well, it's a violation of the law, the Lanham Act to be specific, to deceive consumers and serve them a Pepsi when they ask for a Coke.
They have to ask, is Pepsi okay?
And you can say, we are members of an Ohio university, but there's a lot of Ohio universities. But there's only one, the Ohio State University. And
okay.
So I've had editors of books correct my typing when I wrote the Ohio State. But, of course, that would be like saying Annie instead of Ann. If somebody wants to say that, but that's not the proper name.
Okay.
It is actually a legal issue.
Duly noted.
Yeah.
Blake in Dublin, there you
but
go.
But you wouldn't be the first editor to make the mistake of leaving out the.
Well, it wasn't always a big deal, so.
No, it's always been a big deal.
Well,
it's an important legal issue, and you could go to prison if you did that, just as I did, for something that was not illegal, but that happens.
So you're appealing.
I'm appealing.
But you did. Right about being in prison, I read an interesting excerpt from that was posted online about your breakfast club while you were there. There were a lot of interesting things that you said. One of the things was that you could get an education or you should get a PhD or a graduate degree for being in prison. That it could teach you that much.
Well, yes. And as you can imagine, I'm writing a book on that subject. And one of the things that I found out is I had no idea of what really goes on in prisons. First place, a prison of where I was, with 1,400 people, it has a fence equivalent to the same one that surrounds the OSU golf course. And so all 1,400 people could just walk away anytime they wanted.
It's minimum security.
A lot of people think that everybody who goes to prison is guilty, and that is simply not true. I know you've had Jim and Nancy Petro on, and their book, everybody should read False Justice, because that's what's happening. Someplace between 1 and 20%, and it's hard to establish the actual, of the people in prison are in fact innocent. And I had no idea about that. And that's one of the things that I learned. In my case, there wasn't any crime. What happened was 6,000 people bought stock when the price dropped. Now, they didn't know that we were discussing selling Worthington Foods to Kellogg. And what happened to me happened to all the directors.
But a few of those 6,000 people happened to be people very close to you.
Right. In fact, hundreds of them were close associates of directors. And the reason they bought the stock was because they knew about the company being a good company. The person who also went to prison and her husband had no information of any kind from me about a merger. That just, and there's not one scrap of evidence any place to indicate that.
So this is the basis for your appeal?
Well, the basis is the evidence of my innocence is there, but the prosecutor and the FBI will not give it to us because that would cause the whole case to be vacated. And so we are fighting what's called a FOIA request, as you probably
Freedom of Information Act.
And but, you know, I think one of the things that listeners might be interested in knowing is I didn't make a penny of any kind. There was no motivation of any kind for me to help people who I loved and cared about to make anything illegal. And they didn't have any information for me. The only thing was they said, but you could have told them. And that's why I went to prison, is I could have, not because I did.
You spent 6 years there. You were a super big shot. You traveled all over the place making $10,000 a pop. Doing speaking engagements. You wrote books, some of which are considered, you know, one of which at least is considered a continuing standard bearer on consumerism in the United States. How do you pick up the pieces and start over again?
Well, it was a learning experience. Prison is tough. You live in a 6x8 cell. One night I was in a comfortable home in a king size bed. The next night I'm sleeping on a slab of steel with a 2-inch cotton mattress, called a mattress, or just a pad on top of it, and eating food that your last guest talked about, the food in Cuba. Actually, I always liked Cuban food because it was beans and rice, but I can tell you boiled beans and hard dry rice is not very good when you have it day after day after day. And that's what you have. The food is terrible. And all my worldly possessions were stored in a locker about 4 feet tall and 1 foot wide. And but the people I found there were fascinating people, many good people. There were about 70% of them were drug dealers. And I taught GED classes, and I have never had any more rewarding experiences, even with my PhD students, than these guys. One of them was almost 400 pounds, big dog eye, picked me up and hugged me and said, he got his high school diploma. He said, man, I couldn't have done it without you. And one of the guys carried my books out when I left with tears in his eyes and said, I will miss you. And you go from a life of comfort. But I learned that God calls us to be in places we don't prefer to be, but he goes with us. And if you have a faith, as I did before we went in, you really learn the difference between defending God in your faith versus depending on God in your faith. And many, many people prayed that I would, after I got out, be able to see my father before he died, because he died last week. And he's 96 years old. And he told a good friend, a professor here, who said, I only have one reason to live a little longer, and that's to see my son. And that happened for several months since I got back. And you learn that you can be of service to people wherever. I mean, I taught students. I loved students. I loved teaching. I loved The Ohio State University. And I was in a different place, even though I had done nothing wrong. You know, I'd been on boards for 30 years. A major part of my income came from that. With no reason to do anything illegal, and I didn't. But the average person doesn't get to see that because the evidence was not – the jury didn't get to see it. But, you know, I figured, okay, I'm here. I shouldn't be here. Not the only one there that shouldn't be here, but how can I do the same thing I've always done? And I taught from 7 a.m. to 3:30, 5 days a week. Now, if we have any professors listening, I don't imagine any of them has spent much time teaching all day, every day. And I don't know whether we want Governor Kasich to hear about this, actually, because I've never worked so hard in my life. You know, everybody has to have a job in prison. All work, all cooking, all maintenance, all the security cameras are installed by inmates. And I was fortunate to have a teaching job.
You were convicted of 19 counts stemming from an illegal insider trading tip. That's the bottom line at this point, and that's what a lot of people know. And they're going to look at the conviction, and that's a fact to them, bottom line.
And if anybody believes that's true, they should go back and read the court documents. They will find not one scrap of evidence, not one email or anything that I ever told anybody. All they found was overwhelming evidence that people knew me, bought stock, just as they did hundreds of other people did with other directors, but I was the only one prosecuted.
A lot of folks don't have sympathy for you, as you probably know, even though you've done your time. They don't think you should regain the prominence and the status that you once enjoyed as a marketing professor at Ohio State. They don't think that the Blackwell Inn at Ohio State should still be named for you, even though you contributed the money, $7 million, I think, to build it.
Well, those people
They resent that you're going to be at the Columbus Metropolitan Club this
Those
this
same
Wednesday.
People are probably bigoted about people of different races. They're bigots about gender. You know, we have bigotry tolerated in America about people who have a felony conviction. If I said I don't like blacks or I don't think women should be promoted, we'd think that's politically wrong to say that. We still don't realize there are still human beings walking around in America who say, if you're a felon, you should be punished all your life. But what we should learn is when it's over, it's over. And whether you think I was guilty or anybody was guilty or not, that's like saying a black person shouldn't be given equal rights. And anybody who thinks that a felon shouldn't be given equal rights with anybody else is a bigot.
614-292-8513. We have a few minutes left. My guest is Roger Blackwell, marketing expert, public speaker, former OSU professor. Get the calls in quick. And Mike in Westerville, you're on the air with Roger Blackwell. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Mr. Blackwell, the first thing I wanted to say is I kind of joined the program late, and I'm not calling in to beat you up, but I have kind of a general question to ask you.
Sure.
And I want to know, do you get it that a lot of people in this country, and I'm one of them, feel like, you know, the American dream has been betrayed by a lot of people that work on Wall Street, folks that work on commission, you know, back before the dot-com bubble, we found out that people were lying about the health of the companies whose stock that they were pushing, but they were getting commissions for guiding customers to those particular funds. And then during the real estate bust, there were a lot of people that were brokers that were just getting a big commission, and they didn't care that they were getting loans for people that didn't qualify. And, you know, when people like me look at that, you know,
hey Mike,
it's patently unfair. And what I want to know is, do you get it?
Mike, I'm with you on that. Do you get it? I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't do anything illegal. I've never been on Wall Street. I haven't even visited Wall Street. I was doing my job, and people who were paying attention to the stock market and actually buying on fundamentals said, here's a stock that was selling 22, is selling for 13 or 12 now, and it pays a dividend. It's like money in the bank. That's a good investment, and they made it. And they got punished, and I got punished, and the American taxpayers paid $2 or $3 million. You paid $2 or $3 million for something when there was no crime there.
Thank you, Mike. Let's talk a little bit about what you're going to talk about at the Columbus Metropolitan Club on Wednesday. You are working on a book. I had imagined
several. Books,
I don't
know. Actually.
I was going to say, the more I think about it, I figure you have a handful of books you're working on.
After you've written 35, you can't just stop doing that. You know,
no going back. But this the topic that you're going to bring up on Wednesday is about the census and what it means to our future and what we can learn from that to.
Well, we're going to get very specific about how the census affects everyday life. Housing prices, for example. Do you think housing prices should go back to where they were in 2005 to 2007? Now, if you bought a house 2007 or even worse, if you made the fatal, terrible mistake of refinancing your home with a mortgage higher than your house was really worth, that's a serious problem. And if we have listeners under 40 and they ask me, do you think housing prices will ever be back in my lifetime to where they were? I'd say yes. If you're my age, no. Mm-hmm. Because I heard a program on NPR, so it must be true, that said there are 7 million more homes in America than there are families to live in them. And you see, our problem is the population is increasing very little. And the majority of all population is Hispanic, as the census calls it, Latino, as I prefer to call it. And basically, Franklin County went down 1.9% in population among the white market. Now, fortunately, we went from 20,000 to 50,000 Latinos, and so we need some new houses. But the only way you need more houses in the future is if you bring more people into this country or if the people here start having a lot more children. Now, our population increases a little bit, but it's people over 50 and 60 mainly. And how many new houses do they need? So that's what the census tells you. And my theme of the presentation on Wednesday was, if you don't know the cause, you won't know the cure. And so why did the recession occur? And the recession occurred for just, you can say it in two words, easy credit. I've just spent a couple of weeks looking at the academic journals on why some economies grow fast. And the answer is savings. And if any one of our listeners wants to know how to get this economy growing, go look at the academic journals of what's happening in Singapore and Bangladesh and Japan and other countries, and you will see the problem in America was not fraudulent mortgages. They were a terrible problem to individuals, and I'm sympathetic to what Mike's saying about that. The problem was 100% mortgages, falsified or undocumented loan applications, appraisals that were based upon comparables, because if the price went up 20% in a year, then that raised the appraised price of other homes almost that much. And as a consequence, people could go out and get a PCL on their mortgage, a personal credit for a car or something like that. That's what caused the recession. And if you don't know the cause, you won't know the cure.
Well, let's take a very quick Phil from Alexandria. You're on the air. We only have about a half a minute.
Okay. Yeah, no, I just wanted to go back to what you was talking about before. I also am a felon, one-time felon. And, you are totally treated unfairly. I still was. I got out, couldn't get a job. The only thing I could get was, in the construction industry. You know, it kind of pushed me forward because, you know, I took the job that paid me $60 an hour, which was nothing, and then learned from it and then went and opened my own company. Mm-hmm. So I was pushed into that, you know.
Phil, I hate to cut you off, but we have to go, and I appreciate your call.
And then?
Take care.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We just have about 15 seconds.
I was going to say, if one of the things people can learn is don't be prejudiced against people because they have a felony conviction. If they did something wrong, they paid their time, they did it, now they're out, leave it, and, you know, it's over.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today, Roger Blackwell. Roger Blackwell will be at the Columbus Metropolitan Club on Wednesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.